Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we are here with episode 226 and part one of my conversation with adjunct percussion professor at Benedict College and Columbia, South Carolina-based percussion teacher, Alyssa Castro-Evans. Let's get right to it. While we've met very briefly before, this is the first time that she and I are talking in any real sense. We met through my new association as a committee member with the Percussive Arts Society Health and Wellness Committee. She made some really good points in the meeting, and it seemed like a great opportunity to have her on the show, and so here we are. And I'm glad to have her on because her journey through her own health and wellness makes up a lot of today's content. Alyssa is currently a mostly freelance percussion teacher in the Columbia, South Carolina area, teaching all levels of percussion along with her work at Benedict College, where she works with frequent podcast guest Joe W. Moore III. She comes from a musical family, which she'll talk about, and gets into discussions of wellness, being a minority, teaching challenges, and the origins of her path. And next week, we'll get to the rest, but here we go. We recorded this interview over Skype on January 6, 2020. Yes, that January 6, 2021, the morning before everything went to crap at the U.S. Capitol. That day, and it begins right now. So, Alyssa, tell me your percussion responsibilities as they are right now.
So they are fairly vast and differentiated in the sense that I teach multiple levels. So I teach at a high school where I pull the students out and work with them during two different classes in the day. So I go there 4 days a week. I also do marching band when we are in session. And then at that school, I also have a steel pan group that we rehearse after school once a week for about 2 hours. And actually, that group is primarily made up of wind players, which is really cool. So then outside of the high school arena at the college, that varies semester to semester as I am an adjunct at Benedict College. So currently, the college has been doing all virtual with lessons. So that's kind of what we've been doing. And so I schedule those as needed. I don't have quite as many students this semester as I did in the fall. And then we also started, Dr. Joe Moore is the head professor there. Yeah. And he started doing studio class this year, which is something new for the university. And so I take part in that as well. And anything else really that needs to be done, if they need my help, I'm glad to do it. And then for my private teaching, I actually teach through Music and Arts, but I also have my own studio. So most of my Music and Arts students I have virtually, and then I have some virtual students through my own studio and some in person. So it's really busy in a good way, though. I like having my schedule that way. It's like a puzzle, which I enjoy trying to figure out how to make everything work. And no day looks the same, which I also enjoy a lot. So that's primarily how things are looking. I do some arranging, but not very much. It's usually just during the marching season. And this year kind of didn't really happen at all. So,
first of all, so when did your professional kind of activity start in Columbia?
I would say it was part during my master's degree here. I went to University of South Carolina. And at that time, the first year I took off completely of teaching. And then the second year I started to teach again at the school that I'm currently at, just in a lesser capacity. So mostly just during marching band and then some private lessons in there. And that's also when I started to gig. I didn't really mention that. So some gigging as well. So about 2016 or so is when I started to pick up with more responsibilities, and then it's just grown every year since then.
As you're kind of putting
you know, you're putting kind of your private studio together and you're doing your master's. How did the other parts of your career start coming together?
Slowly, for sure. I mean, it's very much like taking things as you go, in a sense. You know, you try your best while you're juggling school, which is already difficult enough as it is. And you're trying to find a way to like get your name out there, but that's also difficult to do. I guess, especially if you're someone like me who doesn't like to just like walk up to people and like, here's my business card or whatever. So.
You mean the AlyssaCastro.com t-shirt with the, with your resume on the back of it?
Yeah. And that's the funny thing is I still don't truly have like a website, which is a goal of mine very soon. But it really came down to taking like sub gigs essentially for mm-hmm. that, saying yes to basically everything as it came and trying to do a really good job at that. And then from there, things definitely slowly but surely started to pick up. And that goes with teaching, but more on the gig standpoint for sure. With teaching, it was helpful for me to start out with Music and Arts, which is, you know, a national chain. Because, and then also there's a local company here that does subbing and also teaching, but I started as a sub for music lessons. And this is not your traditional kind of setup of like very classical oriented lessons. So it was helpful for me to get into that side of the realm of music teaching, because honestly, that's a lot of what clientele is out there. And it's just slightly different than really what I knew. And so just getting used to that, figuring out through those two places, Music and Arts and the academy that's local here, figuring out how I was going to teach lessons in a way that kept students coming back, like throughout the year, even not just like, we just want to do all state prep or whatever. You know, those sorts of things like audition prep, etc., because those are not sustainable. Through my time with those places, I wasn't really having to worry about recruiting necessarily. So I was really focused on figuring out how to structure lessons in a way that was sustainable, and especially with younger students. I have a good amount of experience teaching young kids. I taught elementary music actually prior to going back to do my master's. And so just trying to figure out a way to put the two experiences together, like some of the knowledge that I have of just overall teaching young children, and then putting that into the context of private lessons where it's not like a collegiate private lesson. Because truthfully, when we're talking about just percussion only, I think it's fairly difficult to make that a sustainable thing of just teaching like middle school and high school percussion lessons, depending on where you're located. In the beginning, especially. So that was definitely for me, I was open to teaching drum set and teaching piano. I have piano background and vocal background. So, and I still do those things, teach piano and vocal, just to kind of keep myself busy and keep things going. Because I wanted to be a freelancer. And so part of being a freelancer is figuring out how to make a living doing that. And so anyway, and so I was really just kind of like figuring it out. And then the recruiting part, that's still a challenge for me, although that's getting better in my own private studio. But I think in the beginning, it was helpful to be a part of a larger store chain that they're kind of doing that recruiting for you. And it took me a little while to kind of get comfortable with it. And now I'm feeling like, yeah, this is definitely something I really like to do. Teaching collegiate private lessons, like, that's not really an issue because I kind of know what that structure is like. And and know what I'm going for. It was trying to find my groove in teaching like anywhere between a 5-year-old and a 15-year-old, like private lessons, and then keeping that, again, like I was saying before, all year round versus like just audition prep.
Well, and also at Benedict, it's Joe's program. So it's, you're just mm-hmm. helping out. It's less of you for you to like, have to really, I guess, you know, put into play. It's more like you're making it work for what he needs to do. Right.
Yeah. And actually I started the year before he got there. So that first year was in transition between the, you know, main professor. And I was like, just trying to keep everything together that middle year. Mm. And you know, that's difficult because I find that in an adjunct position, people are less willing to listen to you and your input. And that's not knocking anyone or no judgment on that at all. But there were some things that they were making it very difficult for the program to run. And I was like, we need this to happen. And things were not happening that way. And so it was just like, okay, well, let's just go hard at it and try to keep things rolling and see how it goes. And it wasn't just me. It was another adjunct as well. So the two of us were just trying to manage everything and try to figure out what the state of transition was going to be for the program. And then once Joe came in, you know, he came in, he's got a vision. And so then definitely for me, it's like, I'm a big fan of his. So, you know, trying to do anything I can to support him and, you know, the vision that he's got for the program too. So it's been interesting because it has shifted through the time that I've been there for sure. And I'm sure it will continue to as the program continues to evolve.
Well, and you're stating a good point about the adjunct in that. You know, it's one of those things where the university doesn't benefit from it being an adjunct thing because you as a professional are just less invested because they're not investing you in the same way. And then people just expect that you're going to bail.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Although that was never my intention, but yeah, right. That's kind of the thought there. But I really enjoyed, and that was also like my first college teaching job. So for me, it was also just overwhelming at first too, because I was like, oh, okay, I have 15 students. Awesome. Like, I need to figure out what to do with all of these. I had just graduated with my master's, and not that I was new to teaching, but it's a different institution. It's a different world. And even still, even though I wasn't new to teaching, I'm still a young teacher in that sense. Like, I haven't been teaching 25 years. I've been teaching at that point, I think, just about 10 or so. But it was so rewarding, like, because of having to deal with all of that. There was a lot of lessons learned for me, for sure, and continue to learn still as I'm in my third year. This year has kind of been just odd, as everyone would probably agree. Yeah. But I have, you know, continuing to kind of think about how I want to structure things. That's a big deal for me. Like, what do I want the students to come out knowing? And really, that goes for all the levels that I teach, and trying to figure out how to make that happen at the different levels. Because some days I'm teaching 3 different levels in a day, a lot of different age groups. And it's funny because sometimes I'll have a really advanced middle schooler that can do some of the same stuff that some of the young college kids can do. And so there's kind of a point to be made of like catering to that specific student, you know, at the same time of trying to have like expectations for each level. I'm never going to try to hold a student back. I'm like, man, if you're ready to go, let's go. Like, we'll just keep moving forward for sure.
What kinds of things did you find and understandably, it's, you know, Benedict's been where you've been kind of located in the college arena. But what kinds of things did you find similar, different teaching there since it's a historically Black college?
The marching band and the role of the marching band within the institution. It's pretty much the bread and butter, I would say.
Yeah.
And so they have a really intense schedule. And so trying to figure out how to get the students basically involved in the non-marching arts part of music has been for sure a challenge. But also you're just trying to compete with that time investment because they practice a lot. They do. And so it was more of a schedule thing, just like trying to figure out how to get them in to the building so they could practice, you know, enough for their lessons. And then in general, just depending on where they come from, because there's really kind of a good variety of skill sets that we've got. And so depending on what program they came from high school really makes a difference on where they are within their lessons. Cause there were a couple students, even some of the students that Joe has now I've worked with. And so some of them were at a school that was more of a drum corps style. And so they have more of that background as well. And so then for them being in the HBCU marching band was kind of a shift for them. Yeah. But then they also had like more concert band in their high school. So then they're more exposed to some of the music, the concert band literature and some of the other stuff. And whether or not they had lessons, I would say primarily most of them did not, though, that I know of prior to schools or to college. So there's definitely some, at least with the specific students we've had and we've been working with, like we've had to kind of work a lot on the mallet standpoint for sure. Getting them caught up kind of in a sense to that. But just also dealing with the variety of levels coming in. I would say there was more of a variety of level with the concert percussion than somewhere like University of South Carolina or something like that, where most of those kids that are auditioning for University of South Carolina or UGA or anywhere like kind of similar to that, they have probably been exposed to some of those things, have had lessons, whatever. But to me, I find working at an HBCU very rewarding. Part of that is because I'm a minority in the field being a female. So I definitely like, it's not the same because right. I'm not a Black person, but I relate to being a minority and I feel for that. And I connect highly with trying, you know, working with people that are not always put in the forefront. And then I am also a Hispanic person, so I am definitely someone that has never really fit into like any sort of box. So that part, and then just also there's been a lot that I have learned throughout the process, things that I didn't know. It wasn't my first experience working at an HBCU. I did like a camp, like a fine arts camp, my first year out of high school in Georgia at Fort Valley State University. Mm-hmm. So that was my first true experience being in the HBCU environment, but that was a camp. So it wasn't like I was immersed into the college. I had some expectation or knowledge of what, you know, being at Benedict would be like, but I also was very happy to know like how welcomed I was too, like with all the faculty around and even with the students. Definitely, I think more than anything, the students at first were like, what is this girl going to teach me how to do? You know, more than anything else. So, but in general, I think it's totally rewarding. And it's definitely something, you know, through all the events, I'm not going to get too political here, but through all the events of this past year has put a lot of perspective and has gotten me to think very more deeply about everything. And makes me want to be at an HBCU even more, because, you know, I can be the champion for them and know that what I'm doing, you know, is I am a white looking person that can help support and be a part of these young, they're almost, I think they're all men at this point. I don't think we have any females in the studio, but be a part of these young men's lives and know and have someone in their life that's like someone that believes in them and that champions them and that is going to be on their side, because I think that's important for them to see and to have someone to work with that, you know, is 100% behind them. And so for me, I am more grateful than ever to be a part of the institution, because it's taught me a lot too.
An inability to be complacent, I think, you know, at a school like that. I taught at an HBCU for 9 years. So, and not only like an inability to be complacent, I would say, at least from my perspective, but also that they'll call you on it. You know, like particularly if you get, the more you get to know, I mean, that's any student, but I would say particularly in an HBCU environment, they're not going to put up with, like faking anything.
Basically. Oh, so yeah.
If you've felt that too.
I mean, I guess, I don't know. I've always, I feel like I'm fairly a very honest person. And so there really isn't a lot of that for me. And I'm just like, if I don't know something,
yeah,
like if there's some cultural things, I just like straight up, I'm like, you're going to have to explain to me. Like, I don't know. Like, yeah. You know,
exactly.
and they're totally cool with that.
Yep. You don't work with the drumline then there, do you?
No, I don't. There's a different staff that works with the drumline, actually. But I do know the instructors. But I mean, they're really good drumline. It's really cool to watch, and you know, the students, they would often come in and like show me videos like, hey, this is what we're working on, and this is from part of their schedule too. I didn't mention, it's not just like marching band, but it's also like their competitions that they do.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yep.
It goes past football season.
Oh yeah. No, like, I know.
You know,
yep.
It is all year round. Like, and so there is no like dying down of the activity. So there's like, you know, showing me the battles and stuff, and, and it's just really, really cool. And in so many ways, I'm like, man, I wish I was a part of something like that. Cause it's so fun.
Yeah.
Like, you know, not that what I did wasn't fun, but like,
it's a different level.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so much groovy, cool stuff that I'm like, man, this is awesome.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of them. Like,
yes,
it's a big group. And most of them are not music majors, but the ones that are, you know, there is something to be said, like any school with a lot of marching involvement, like of the chops that are required to be part of something like that, that you transfer over to their other playing. So it's never an issue with those kids, like as to whether or not they have hands or anything like that. It's always like, okay, let's find what you're deficient at and let's like go hard at that.
Right. One of my favorite experiences, I had a student who kind of, he was our drum captain for the last bunch of years that I was there. And I'm going to say you're probably familiar with Liber Tango, right?
Yeah.
Sure. I was practicing that in my office and he came in because he had to chat with me about something. And he starts playing, like putting in like a 2 and 4. Just like as like an HB, like he would if he was in the drum line while I was playing it. And it completely changed how I played the piece for like 4 years.
Like, oh, wow. Yeah.
Like, it was like this groove part where I was like, oh yeah, like that is also in there.
That's so true. That's totally true.
So, yeah.
I love that piece though.
Yeah. Yeah. was your intention as you were getting more, like you were doing more teaching when you were finishing up your master's, was your intention to stay there?
Actually, no. It was kind of a unfortunate series of events my last semester at South Carolina, because within like the first 3 weeks of the semester, my husband lost his job. He was a grant funded position at the VA, and that money disappeared. And so with like 4 hours notice, lost his job. And so I was like, okay, well, we don't have a choice but to stay for me to finish. I called my dad, you know, talked to my parents and try to figure out what to do. And they're like, no, just stay there, finish. Within the next month or so, my husband found a job in the restaurant industry. And so he kind of made a pretty big switch from experimental psychology to that. And so as he started to get into that industry, he started to really like it. And as things were kind of winding down, finished the degree, we decided at that point, like, maybe we'll go back to Georgia because we're both from Georgia. And then I got the Benedict job and I was teaching, I was gigging a little bit. And I was like, well, let's just stay for now since you're really liking this and, you know, possibly want to make this your new career. So we kind of waited it out a little bit and we've continued to do that. And then he got a different job and has moved up. So we've kind of, and now he really likes where he's at and I like what I'm doing, with the variety of stuff that I'm doing. So we kind of just decided at this point that we're just going to stay here. So it was not necessarily the plan, but we were open to it, if that makes sense. So kind of waited things out because not every place can you make a freelancing career work. Especially like, for example, like going back to our hometown area. Well, my dad kind of does what I'm doing. So it's hard to like try to figure out how I'm going to have work when he's kind of doing what I'm doing. And so, you know, to compete with him and some of the other people. So, you know, it seemed like it was viable for me to stay here, at least for now, and for also for my husband. And so we've continued to do that.
Is he still in the restaurant industry?
Yeah. Yeah. He's just moved up the reins now, or up the ladder. And so went from just someone who was learning how to cook on a line to now being a full kitchen manager. So at a different place that is a pretty well performing restaurant. It's definitely, it's like the number one.
Even now?
Yeah. 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 Even now, even through the pandemic, restaurant industry, huge blow.
Yeah.
Cause it has been a big blow to the restaurant industry, not just the music industry, but they continue to be like number one on TripAdvisor for Columbia, et cetera. So it's been a good thing. And so we've kind of decided that we're going to just stay here for now and see how things go. We're buying a house. And so we're going to
really staying around for,
we're going to stay. Yeah. So, you know, sometimes in life, like you kind of have to ride it out a little bit and just wait and see. Especially like I was mentioning earlier with being trying to create like a freelancing career, it takes time. Like, so you can't just expect within a year or two that you're going to be where you want to be. And so that was another thing. I was like, well, I wanted to, as things start to get better, I was like, maybe we should just stay here because things are getting better. And if we were to move, then it's like kind of starting all over again on that process, for sure. So that's kind of where we're at, where we were at and where we are at. And I will say that once with Benedict specifically, once Joe came into the picture, then I definitely wanted to stay because I was like, he's going to take this place to, you know, this school places, I think, or this program. And I want to be a part of that. So For sure. And I also like the orchestra I play with, although I could move and still play with the orchestra. That's the thing about some of the gigging stuff. It's like, you know, you can kind of move and still make that work. But, and I love my high school that I work with, and I love the director I work with. And that's not always the case. I've worked at a lot of high schools, and when you find some good people to be around, it's definitely nice and a breath of fresh air. And you're like, I'm going to make use of this as long as I can, I think.
Other thing I know that you're doing, which is the way that I figured out who you were, is that you're on the health and wellness committee for PAS.
Yeah.
So what's your experience been with that so far?
Health and wellness in general has been, or has become, a huge part of my life. It was always a part of my life, but in a way that was frustration, I guess. And then I'll explain more about that. But throughout some life changes, I guess, coming to University of South Carolina, et cetera, changing career or pivoting in my career, so to speak, I found some success in making headway in my own health and wellness. And so there was a lot of me sharing that on social media. I got in contact with Brad Meyer, and Brad is also an alumnus of University of South Carolina. And so he, you know, was asking me, he's like, hey, I really think you should apply to be a part of the health and wellness committee. And I was like, I don't know, we'll see. And the more I thought about it, I was like, you know, this would be really cool to do and be a part of. And because most of my health and wellness journey, which is kind of cliche at this point, but most of that has been more of a personal thing. It is something I find myself talking about a lot with my students still. So I was like, you know, it would be probably a good thing to figure out a way to, because there's a lot of the things that really helped me were like life changing in many ways. Why wouldn't I pass that on to my students? It's been really cool to be around other percussionists, specifically percussionists who, you know, are involved with this and in so many ways, like even further in depth, of course, than for me, it's just like mostly just personal. But, you know, some of the people that are on the committee are writing papers and doing all this cool research, and there's just so much that I'm interested in. So it's really nice to be around other educators and musicians that see a value in that, because sometimes it can be just like this thing that gets pushed to the side. And often I felt like very alone in that journey. Like I was like the odd one for like bringing my healthy lunch to school for sure. Everyone's like, you want to go out to eat? And I'm like, I mean, I got my healthy food right here, you know? But it's been really cool and another huge learning experience and something I've been trying to rack my brain on how I can contribute more to the committee outside of just me being an advocate with my students for health and wellness. And so I'm trying to think of some different ideas.
Alyssa, McDonald's makes a grilled chicken sandwich. I don't know what the big problem is.
Oh, don't get me started on McDonald's.
Why do you say that? Here's my
you've got your McDonald's.
Yeah, you got my iced coffee.
Yeah. But I mean, it was actually my time at South Carolina. I had just pivoted from teaching elementary school music. I left that job to go back to school. I was so unhappy doing that, and it wasn't really teaching that I was unhappy with. It was the environment, and also just teaching elementary music was very repetitive to me. And I didn't have very good administration, et cetera, unfortunately. And it just like took a toll on my mental health. But at that time, I was already dealing with a number of health issues that I just couldn't quite get a handle on. And so when I was at USC, it was an opportunity because my schedule went way down as far as time. I had so much more time to devote on myself. It was like, what do I do with myself besides practice all day?
Like, do you mean like scheduled versus unscheduled kind of situation?
Yes. Yeah. Scheduled versus unscheduled. Definitely. So I, you know, had the opportunity to create my own schedule in that sense. Like, I'm going to practice during this time. And a lot of my initial success with making headway in the health part, which is physical and mental for me, was just that pivot, was moving somewhere else, having a fresh start, definitely got me going. And for me, it was a lot of the health issues that I have centered around me being heavily overweight. And so I started to lose weight, actually, like almost unintentionally throughout my first semester at USC. And I was like, huh, interesting. And then I started to take more time for my mental side. And then just, it's amazing how the two impact each other very much. So as I was seeing success, I was like, wow, this is really interesting. But I also was still having trouble with being like kind of foggy brain because I was on a lot of medications as well. So then I was like, I gotta figure this out. So it was a combination of seeing success, but then also getting more curious at the same time and trying to really become more of an advocate for myself within the health side of things, specifically when you're working with doctors. I think you have to be a big advocate for yourself because a lot of times doctors aren't going to do that deep digging to figure out like root causes of stuff. Because I was having trouble like remembering stuff, like, and that was kind of alarming to me. I was like, this was easier in undergraduate. Like, why am I having trouble remembering? Oh, well, maybe it's this medicine that I'm on. And so, you know, so it was just like, I took that time through my master's as an overall, like, this is my time for me to become a better musician and to become like a healthier person. So I kind of coupled the two together and found a lot of success with that. I started adding exercising into things by the second year. And, you know, typically with anything that you do, not just health or sports or whatever, when you start to see success, that breeds more success. So, and having the time to do that, because I guess one of the big stories that I had before was like, I don't have time to do that. And so then I had some time to do that. And then I figured out how to kind of get into a groove with it. And then as things got really busy again, because they did eventually pick up and get pretty busy, as you know, being in graduate school, it's not, you do have unscheduled time, but it's not necessarily not busy.
Right.
Then I started to figure out like how I can make it all work and make it sustainable and then continue that after school, like, and being a busy person, you know, freelancing and et cetera. So it's definitely been, you know, you're one of those things where perseverance is very important and being okay with like, you know, you're going to fail. And I think there's so many parallels between music and that. So I just found it very helpful to be like pursuing both at the same time, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because like, it was easy for me to make those connections. Like, of course, like I need to spend time on my health. Like I spend time on my practicing to become a better player. So why wouldn't I need to spend more time on myself to become a healthier person? You know what I mean? It was a very important time for me and I cherish it very, very much.
Yeah.
And now it's just like a hobby in the sense, like a deep interest of mine. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's all awesome.
And a lot of it ends up being coming down to like insurance,
sure?
You know, because like, oh, well, this is, you know, insurance is going to cover this. So this is, you know, this association now recommends that you get this test now only every 10 years instead of every 5, you know, those sorts of things and guidelines that people set in place, you know, that's like kind of like for the normal average human being, but like based on what I see around me in the United States specifically, our rate of like obesity and other health issues is really quite high. So a lot of these recommendations are not really for the standard person, actually. It seems, at least, you know, they're for like the bare minimum of like normal, healthy people. But I also, you know, again, there's, because it's not like standard procedure, just because it's not standard procedure doesn't mean that you can't have it done or whatever. Like, for example, I like to get my blood tests done regularly, and I like them to be detailed.
Yeah.
And so there's extra vitamin and mineral levels that I'm very passionate about this that like doctors don't typically test for. So like sometimes you have to specifically ask, like, hey, I want all of these tested for. And sometimes that means that you're paying more money, or a lot of times that means you're paying more money. But right. To me, it's worth it to know like what's going on. And, you know, also sometimes that means you have to change doctors, which I've had to do quite a few times. But yeah, I had a lot of like bad experiences, I guess, in my early 20s through all of that, yeah. And seeing like specialists and still not really getting anywhere, you know? So,
well, and you know, it's one of the things I've learned the last couple of years is that, and I'm sure that you figured this out too, is that a lot of times the, like medication dosage, for instance, is based on like white men.
And oh, they yeah.
Have no idea the amounts that really women should have. Like they have not tested it enough. They've not, mm-hmm. They've decided it's not important. Like, I don't know even where to go further, but it was like, oh, well, that's a problem.
Yeah, that is a problem. And I didn't know about that until more recently. As I've been doing just more research and just podcasts, listening to podcasts and stuff and that specifically, you know, kind of coming full circle back into, Black women and Black men, like that yeah. same issue is huge.
Yeah.
With like medications, and then with, as I'm learning through pregnancy with Black women, the mortality rate is so much higher, and there's specific reasons for that because of one, lack of research, and two, lack of just knowledge about, from the doctor's standpoint of understanding like the needs of these patients. So, you know, it's really important overall in general in health, just to be that advocate, like we were talking about, but also to spend some time doing research on these things. So if, you know, your doctor says you need to be on a medicine, you go research that, you know, don't just be like blindly saying yes, yes, yes. Like you don't have to say that. There's also consent. You know, are they asking you, or are they telling you? Because those are two different things. In the health world, and some doctors don't really do a good job of asking. They just tell you. And that's technically not allowed. So, you know, it's just being informed, I think, is really helpful. And I think when you're in your 20s, for me, not so much because I was already aware that I had some health problems. But when you're in your 20s, you're like, oh, I'm 20, I'm young, I'm healthy, and blah, blah, blah. And that's kind of where we run into things with the college students. We're trying to share stuff with the college students. And when you're in college, especially undergraduate, you're like kind of invincible. Like you feel like you're that way. And it's like, no, you actually still have a chance to develop, you know, serious health problems, even when you're young, because that was something I got a lot from other people. Oh, you shouldn't be on that medicine. Like, you're so young. Why are you having all these problems? And I'm like, well, I don't know, but like, I am. It's not very helpful for you to say that to me.
Yeah.
And some of that was like family members, like, oh, you're so young. That common like misconception of like age is health is a problem. Yeah. Because I've known women younger than me that have been diagnosed with breast cancer, you know, in their late 20s, which is not normal, but it happens. And so being aware and using the services that you have, like, for example, at the college level, if you don't have insurance, you have to have it through the university.
Right.
And you have those services to use. Like, go use them.
Yeah.
Go to the student health center. Use it. Go see the doctor. I made use of it in my graduate time, for sure.
Shoot, the mental health facilities that are available. Were not available when I was an undergrad, but it's all there.
And that's a big part of it. And this was kind of in one of the panels from this year's PASIC. There is no substitute for going to the therapist, going to see someone like a psychiatrist for these issues. Make use of this service that the school has. You know, we can try to help them as much as we can, but we're not those people. I'm not a therapist. I'm not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist. But I am good at listening, yes. And I can give you advice and I can certainly try to help you, you know, point you in the right direction. However, there just isn't a substitute for that. And one of the things I will mention is those things are kind of costly when you're not in school. So that's something I've mentioned too. I'm like, listen, make use of this because it's usually free through the school. Right. And make use of it because this stuff is not cheap when you're going through things like this and you're having to go see a therapist and you're, you know, chunking out, you know, so however much money each session.
It's almost less that it's free, but it's framing it as you're already paying for this through your fees or, you know, all this other stuff. You may not know that you're doing that. So, yeah, I mean, like, the undergrad, like, yeah, when I realized that the weight room was free, it's like, oh, well, I might as well lift some weights. Like,
I mean, it was a lot of money for that, at least here at University of South Carolina. I mean, and as a graduate student, we still had to pay for it, the health center.
Yeah.
Like, so I used it. And luckily, it's like a few blocks down the road from the music school, but I'd go swim and go use it because I'm like, man, you guys are charging me a lot of money every semester. But you look at things differently when you're a graduate student, I think, because you're paying for it.
Yeah.
And so you're like, oh, wow, that's a lot of money. I should use that. but I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I definitely didn't make use of in my undergrad. Because of convenience and time. And so, but that's again, like, that's kind of a mindset adjustment with time that I've had to learn the hard way. And it's taken me a long time, which is like the quote, never having enough time to take that extra time needed for myself to one, sleep. That's my worst one. I'm still working on it.
It's not getting any better.
In the
summer.
Oh no, having a child is not going to make that easier. But I'm trying my best, at least through pregnancy, to sleep more. But you know, sleeping, taking care of yourself, you know, taking time to not do practicing and other school stuff to like actually decompress. Stress is not a great thing. Like, it can be for, you know, small stressors and things are good for you, of course. But overall, being a super stressed out person, wearing your how much time you spend on things as a badge of honor and, oh, I never sleep. I do. You know, I certainly did. It's like, you know, I did all this work and I only slept 2 hours. Like, that to me was like a good thing.
Yeah.
But I didn't, you know, I didn't really realize like how much of a toll all that was taking on me, you know, mentally and physically. And so my goal with my students, high school and up, is to try to get them, try to talk about that. And I do, and I talk about those things very honestly with them, especially if it comes up. I'm like, all right, sometimes making sure I'm asking, hey, are you sleeping? Like, are you... how much time are you spending? Like,
have you eaten today?
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Yeah.
And what have you eaten? And making recommendations. I've had some students ask me like, what are you doing? Like, or what do you, are you lifting weights or whatever? And so I'll tell them like kind of some of the stuff, but my recommendation is always just like move somehow, walk, do something, find something you like, and do it, and try to be consistent with it. But more than that, it's like scheduling that time in. And that's part of like just in college, like learning how to schedule, which is hard. Mm-hmm. You know, like you're trying to figure out this whole like Mondays are this, Tuesdays are this, Wednesdays are this, and scheduling out one, your practice time, your lesson time, your class times, et cetera. But also like where in there did you schedule time to eat? Did you schedule time to like actually sleep? You know, do something that you enjoy, like watch TV for a second, like play a video game, like just something to decompress and not just have like work all the time. Now, not every student's like that, of course, but the ones you typically can tell which ones are that are like work. And then those are the ones that you gotta sometimes take the time to like intervene with and be like, hey, don't forget, like, it's okay to like do other things. I was definitely that person and continue to be that person, but that skill's so important because not every day looks the same for me now. So it's scheduling those things in. That's still something I do have to figure out, like, when am I going to do this? And I'm sure it's just going to get harder with a child, but like, when am I going to take the time to cook or eat or like go on a walk or meditate or whatever it is, read a book.
Yeah.
And then practice, which as we all know in the career space, the practicing part becomes a little bit more challenging to find the time to do. But, you know, we got to make it work.
Right. Yeah. When are you going to play Merlin and Velocities, you know, and Northern Lights and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah. I don't know about. I'm not playing Merlin again. I already did that. Play Northern Lights, though. And that's a long one.
That's a long one.
I don't know. We'll see. But, I mean, I've prepared a couple of friends of mine are starting a publishing company, and I was asked to prepare and record like two miniatures last month. And so I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to find time to like prep these and memorize them and play them and record them. And so that was another moment where I was just like, all right, I have to make sure that I schedule those things in, that practice time in between everything else to get that stuff ready in time. And while I'm juggling teaching and trying to buy a house and all the adulting things that are just so fun. but, you know, it's so worth it, though. And it's a skill that has to be learned for sure. I don't think high school sets you up for that, right? No, and well, even a regular full-time job, I don't think always sets you up for that, because I had that before and it was a pretty predictable schedule. And so I definitely, in those first 2 years when you were asking me about that, that was a challenge. It's still a work in progress, I'd say.
One thing that you said much earlier that I'm just curious about, because it was that, I guess this was when you were starting your master's, that you found yourself, you said something like you lost weight, but you weren't like, not necessarily by design, you just did.
Mm-hmm.
Did you figure out what happened?
I think some of it was just like letting go of some of the mental distress that I was in, honestly. I have always tended to eat fairly healthy. Basically because I was in undergrad when I was like going to the specialists and trying to figure out like what to do about some of my conditions. But I let that time excuse really get to me for the eating part in undergraduate. But then when I was teaching full time, those 3 years after, I was eating pretty decently. Maybe the last 2 years of teaching full time that I'm thinking about it. So I kind of was already in a little bit of a routine of eating fairly well. I was also trying to figure out like how to not overspend my money on like eating out all the time.
Sure.
So making and preparing my own food, bringing that for lunch, bringing snacks, basically doing my own food. I'm for me, that's a big deal. With food is making my own food, because it just ends up being a lot healthier that way. Even if you're like not even making the healthiest meals,
right,
it's still gonna be healthier. I mean, yeah. No disrespect to restaurants, because it's in the industry, but I know what they do.
Yeah.
They put a lot of salt and they put a lot of oil.
Yeah.
And a that's lot of why butter. It tastes so good.
Yeah.
I think that had a lot to do with it, was bringing my own food, to try to be like a little frugal on that sense, because I had a full-time job, and then all of a sudden I was like in school, not making money anymore, really. And so I was like trying to save money, make my own food, bring it to school, eat it. And then also just the mental part, I think, was very helpful. The release of stress, because when you think you can't do something, or you will make that happen for yourself. So I was kind of stuck in like, oh, I can't lose this weight. And so then all of the circumstances around me changed. And so did my thoughts too, which is the important part. The circumstances don't really create the change, but it's the thoughts that do. And so I was like, oh, you know, throughout, because there was a lot of mental things happening through going back to school. It's like, you know, I hadn't played in like 3 years almost, basically. So I was like trying to get my chops back, and just like there's a lot of things I was working through, and trying to like work on believing like, oh, okay, I can do this. And, you know, it tends to bleed over into other parts of your life, depending on who you are. But that was probably the biggest thing, was the mental stress relief. Even though graduate school has its own stressor, I felt like this was like my time again. Like I was doing this for me, no one else. And just that change of mindset was really helpful. And eating well is a huge part of things. I wasn't really exercising, I will say that. Mm-hmm. I didn't start that until I had lost probably about 40 or 50 pounds. Total, I've lost, I've gained some back, especially now since I'm pregnant, obviously, but my grand total of weight loss was up to 120 lost. So pretty big changes. Like
you lost a person.
I lost a person. Yeah. And I have a picture that I love going back to, in front of the school sign, School of Music sign, wearing the same outfit, like at the beginning of my master's and the end. And it's pretty different person. But I think when you're trying to create that kind of a change, it's so much more than physical. And that's what I can't stress enough. I know I've said it already like 3 times, but, there's so much mentally that has to change. Like you have to become someone, not different, but a lot of the way that you live has to change in order to make that happen. And then to sustain it. That's another part of the process, which is challenging on its own. But I was also seeing that momentum, and that momentum is very motivating. So if you make use of momentum when you see it, and that goes with anything in life, practicing, health stuff, any sort of goal, when you see that momentum and you can capitalize on it, you can make a lot of stuff happen in a pretty short amount of time. Cause I think that was probably like my most productive 2 years, in a while for sure.
You can tell me not to put this in. That'd be fine. I'm just curious. When did your husband enter the picture? And I only ask that just in terms of,
oh, it doesn't matter. I want you to leave this in.
Okay, good. All right, great. Yeah.
All right. So my husband came into the picture because of percussion ensemble. So we met in our first year of college, which is insane because that's been a long time now. And we met in percussion ensemble because my dad, who is a percussionist and percussion teacher, I was at, I went to two different schools for undergrad. I did the AA and transferred thing. And so I was at his school first at Middle Georgia. It's now Middle Georgia State. And so we were both in percussion ensemble because my dad had taught his older brother years past. So my dad actually already knew his family. I didn't. But I had just moved from Florida. I went to high school, middle school in Florida. And so I just moved back to Georgia to home, essentially. Joined percussion ensemble, did the percussion ensemble thing. It was the second semester of percussion ensemble that we started to like get to know each other. He came to my birthday party and all that sort of thing. And then we just started dating. And I was so scared. I like asked my dad permission. I was like, can I go on a date with Paul? And so that's just kind of how it started. And he's just so amazing and a sweet, sensitive, awesome person. And we just kind of dated and things kept going. And then when it was time to leave Middle Georgia, I auditioned for Columbus State University Schwab School of Music, which is a really awesome school. I was like, he was doing psychology. So he is a percussionist, more of a drum set player for sure, and a good one. But I was like, hey, you know, I want us to stay together. Like, do you want to go to the same school as me? Because this is this really the only option that I want to do. Is going to this school, assuming I get in, which is kind of hard to get in there at the time. And so he was like, I don't care. I'm psychology. So I can like literally work on that anywhere. Exactly. So when I got into Columbus State, he also went to Columbus State. And so we moved to Columbus together. That was another huge, like life-changing kind of experience that I haven't even touched on yet. Columbus was incredible and we grew a lot through there because we were only in our like second year of being together at that point. Throughout that time, we dated for a long time. We didn't get married until 2018 and we started dating in 2008. So we dated for 10 years total.
Okay. I'm sorry. So did my wife and I.
Okay.
Yeah.
10 years. And it was because we were doing the whole like trying to figure out the career thing and doing the stuff. And like I was teaching and then he was doing his master's. And so we just kind of made it work through all the different situations. I mean, I feel like we moved like 8 or 9 times, like so many times. Sometimes we lived together, sometimes we didn't. But I love that he's someone that loves percussion, first of all, too. I mean, this is very helpful because what we do is kind of weird sometimes. I mean, just saying.
Yeah.
And he's totally into it. Like, he went to PASIC with us that first year I was dating him. My dad, he always, like, tries to bring as many students with him to PASIC as possible. And so we drove to Texas. We drove from Georgia to Texas, which was a long drive, but mm-hmm. You know, he did it and was like, this is what PASIC is, and like got to experience that. And so almost every
and
year,
Austin too.
Yeah, Austin. Yeah. Almost every year that PASIC has happened, he's been there also with me. So there's only been a couple times where he couldn't come because of work, but he's super into it. He loves it and he gets it. And so he's so supportive of that and music, and that's also very a big connecting point for us too, is percussion and music. And I love that. I mean, I wasn't set on like being with a musician. Both my parents, my whole family are musicians, so I wasn't like set on that happening, but it just kind of did. But he has other interests as well. But I love that you asked me that, because percussion is why we are together. We wouldn't know each other if it wasn't for percussion and being in percussion ensemble at our university. Like, it wouldn't have been a thing. I think it was also helpful that my dad already knew his family, and his family is amazing. And so I, you know, felt really good about the relationship in general very early on. And so we just make it work because, you know, it's not always easy, but we make it work. Yeah.
That's good. All right. Well, let's back up. You've already talked about your dad a little bit. So I don't have to ask you if you have any family members in the arts. What is your dad's kind of focus as a musician?
Oh, he's so diverse. he's very diverse. But his focus, I would say, is world percussion, and teaching. Those are his focuses. He plays a lot. He gigs a lot. And he teaches multiple levels. High school, some middle school, and collegiate. And with the collegiate, he's been at Middle Georgia for 21 years now, I think. And then prior to that, he was at Mercer University in Macon. And so he's from the Dominican Republic. So Latin percussion especially is home for him. Playing tambora, merengue music, that sort of thing. That's a big part of his life. And to the point where he's actually presented at PASIC twice, I think, now on tambora specifically. So, like, he's so passionate about that. But he teaches, like, the classic stuff, like percussion ensemble, all that sort of thing. And in lessons, the standard stuff. But he definitely interweaves a lot more of the world percussion than most, because that is definitely a big part of his background. And he also collects instruments. He has an insane amount of world percussion instruments. I learn something every time I see him, and I'm like, what's this instrument? And blah, blah, blah. And he knows all the history. This is from South Africa and blah, blah, blah. He also speaks a lot of languages. So he's just one of those people that, as a teacher or as a student, actually, you're just like, dang, you know so much. I'm like, how do you remember all of that stuff? Like, I don't know how your brain remembers that. And that, you know, that's a big part of actually why I wanted to teach, because I grew up seeing his influence teaching marching band. I would go to drum camp and band camp with him from a very early age, not wearing earplugs because we didn't know, and just sitting and watching and seeing like the incredible impact on students that he has made. And students still come to him today from 20 years ago, like, oh, you know, Miguel changed my life and blah, blah, blah. And like, he's like a second dad to these people. And that was a huge influence for me, because I saw like the impact that he made, and a big part of why I love teaching, for sure. But also seeing him play is really cool too. I strive to be like half of, maybe by the time I'm his age, half of what he is. He's just an amazing person.
Yeah. But you can also hold over him that you have a child, like you bore, you know.
That's true. Yeah. He's very excited to be a grandpa.
Oh, that's awesome.
Abuelo.
That's right.
yeah. So, and I'm sure the child will be very much exposed to percussion instruments. But he didn't force, my brother's also a percussionist, but he didn't force either one of us like to play percussion. It was just there.
Yeah.
You know, it was just there and around.
You would just be stumbling over all this hand percussion in the room.
Yeah.
You'd be like, oh, well, you stumbled over that. Here's how you play in a fouché. You know, it's just like that.
Yeah. I mean, like literally the kind of collection that he has is like, they became furniture in some ways. Oh, that's the drum table.
Yes.
Put a piece of glass on top of it, and that's now a drum table. Okay. Yeah. And I wish I could remember the name of it, but
yeah,
the specific name. But
I may be wrong on that. I think on this that I think that's how in lots of Central American, Caribbean, South American countries, that's how they hid a lot of the percussion equipment. When there were cultures where that was not allowed, was they used it actually, they, it was like, no, it's a table.
See, I don't know about that. That's, yeah. I'm going to have to ask him because I'm sure he probably would know.
Yeah. We had a student at Mizzou who is from Costa Rica who gave a talk about the kind of the nature of using, saying like, no, it's a table. No, it's this whole lamp, like that kind of stuff.
That's so fascinating.
Yeah. So that's where I was
okay. coming from.
That when you said fern, like no literally, like I think literally that's
yeah,
it's actually the case.
Yeah.
What about your mom? Because you said that she's also a musician, right?
Yeah, she's a clarinetist. She was in the Air Force band when I was growing up, so that was kind of my first experience, like military life and military band and all of that. So she was in the Air Force band, got a lot of cool experiences through that. She was in a traveling band, so she was gone a lot through my early childhood, doing trips and all this stuff. So traveling basically around the world. We lived in Germany for part of that time, and my dad gigged a lot in Europe, especially because he speaks like 6 or 7 languages. So he was fairly successful in being able to bridge any language barriers and playing. But my mom, especially when we were in Europe, they were everywhere. And it was incredible because we had moved there like shortly after the Berlin Wall came down.
Yeah.
Like 6 months after, I think it was. So a very unique time to be kind of in that area. But she, prior to that, she is a graduate of Juilliard and Manhattan School of Music. She kind of worked her way up to being able to do that. I don't know that she took a lot of lessons in her young life, and she waited tables in New York City to like make it work. And so I kind of grew up hearing that story. Both my parents of just like that hard work mentality, which coming, you know, back to like that health and wellness conversation we were having, like that's part of what I had to like figure out, like how to take care of myself, because I grew up with this, like, you got to work hard, you know, to get anywhere sort of thing. And there's nothing wrong with that, but there's like a balance to it.
Right.
But yeah, she's incredible. She now, since getting out of the military, she teaches elementary music and still plays. And teaches adjunct as well. But she did have us try. I had to play clarinet. I was not very good at it, and I didn't really like it. She had us try a lot of different instruments. She was definitely the more forceful of the two, of like trying different instruments when we were younger. Like, it was not an option for me to play piano. At least that's how I remember it. So piano was like my first formal instrument, so to speak. Then I think I tried violin and I didn't like that either. But I also played flute for a good minute, like at least a year or two. So it was definitely not like you have to do music, especially not for a career. She actually got to the point in high school, when I was in high school, where she was like actively discouraging myself and my brother from like being in the music industry. And I was like, I mean, at this point, this has been our life. I mean, we'll see. But so I grew up hearing a lot of like clarinet excerpts from her, a lot of that classical stuff, which I love listening to.
And meanwhile, your father is trying to put a Wamanco groove.
Yes.
On top of that.
100%. For sure. Yeah, and that's the thing. It's kind of interesting because I think the assumption was like, oh, well, your dad's a percussionist. so you just know how to do all that stuff. And it was like, actually, no. Like I know what it sounds like. I know what it kind of like looks like, but I spent my middle school and high school years not living with him. I lived in another state. So I wasn't taking lessons with him or anything like that. And formally learning some of that stuff. And so even now, like I went home this summer for a couple weeks to teach band camp to his house. And I was like, hey, can we do some conga lessons? Like sit down and do some of that stuff so I can get some more formal training of it instead of just like some of the informal stuff that tends to not stick. So for me, like that's one of my big goals is trying to, every time I go see him, trying to like do a small lesson on something to get some of that training. Because even when I did study with him at Middle Georgia, I was basically prepping to get into Columbus State. So I was still like classical driven. And I was very heavy into four mallet playing, which is not really like his area. So I kind of had my own thing and kind of, you know, when you're young, you like, you just do your own thing. Mm-hmm. I was kind of that stubborn kid. I was like, I want to have my own thing and I want to do my own thing. So, as I get older, I'm like, I really want to know all these things that I feel like I've missed out on learning from him. So that's definitely a goal for me is to learn some more from him and find a way to get videos of him playing and talking about things. And so that way later on in life, like I have an easier time recollecting these things. 'Cause I know I can't remember as much as he can.
Why was some of your schooling done in Florida?
So my parents split. Mm-hmm. And so when they divorced, I was, I think, in the beginning of fifth grade. So my mom moved to Orlando and my brother and I went with. And my dad had already created his whole, like, freelance, because that's what he does, too. He had his network set up and had all his work already set up and gigs and teaching. So he stayed, which I understand. And we went to Orlando, Florida, and I did the remainder of fifth grade, middle school and high school in Orlando. And I didn't want to go. I wanted to stay in Georgia. However, a lot in Florida happened for me. There was a lot of things that happened in Florida for me because especially in the Orlando area, Florida has a pretty big percussion community. And so, and to me, in my opinion, pretty good schools as well. So, I was a pretty academic child. And so school was a little bit more difficult in Florida than it was in Georgia, which I liked. And then band, I got, you know, got to the chance in middle school to join band and played percussion and all of that. And high school was really where percussion became like an even bigger part of my life. Because again, before that I was playing piano. I was doing other stuff, music, but other stuff.
Choir as well.
And choir. Yeah. I started singing in middle school. I saw Rossini's Barber of Seville in English because my mom was playing in it. And I saw that and that was my first opera experience live. And I thought it was incredible. And so I became hooked. And then I started to realize, oh, I think I can actually sing like, okay. And so I started to do that a little bit too. Uh-huh. So I did choir a little bit. In middle school and just became obsessed with like opera singing kind of stuff, specifically Rossini. And anyway, the school that I went to, the high school I went to, University High School in Orlando, had like a big marching program. Most of the schools actually in that area have big marching programs. They're all very good programs. And I just fell in love with that. I saw four mallet playing and I was like, Oh my gosh. Well, I kind of was exposed to Format playing a little bit earlier, but I didn't see it. It was like my dad had like CDs of like Rebecca Kite and some other stuff. So I listened to it, and like he didn't play like the Muster Stevens grip until later on in life, because that's largely an American thing, mm-hmm. and he's not American. And so, and he learned it eventually, but that's not necessarily his strength. And so like, I saw that, I was like, oh my gosh, I have to learn how to do this format thing, because to me it was like piano, but not. And yeah. That's when I shifted away from piano, because I was like, oh, I can like look at this music and understand it, but like, I can't play it. it's a different beast. So yeah. I was like bound and determined, because of my experience being in front ensemble at the high school. And I was like, I'm going to learn how to do this Stevens grip. I had a pretty old school teacher too. So, even for him, it wasn't like a big push for that, but I was like a very determined child. So I was like, I'm going to teach myself whatever. I'm going to learn how to do this. And like, to the point where I was one of those stupid kids who learned two Mexican dances as a freshman.
Like one of your first pieces or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not the right piece. I think you know that.
No, absolutely not. But because of my piano brain, I was like, oh yeah, I understand this. And mm-hmm. then it was like trying to figure out how to actually play it.
Yeah.
So that was a huge influence. Just a note, like you probably know these two people, but at that point I looked up heavily, and still do, to Omar Cardenatis. Mm-hmm. He went to the same high school, and his sister was in band with me, and Oliver Molina, who was my drum tech in early high school. So
awesome.
And I was by UCF. And so I was like, yeah, immersed in this.
Which is where Joe went to school too.
Exactly. I know, it's a crazy small world.
Yeah. I've had both Omar and Oliver on the show.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a crazy small world. And, huh. And I was kind of immersed in this like community. I would go to all the percussion ensemble concerts, and my mom was teaching at Rollins College, which Beth Gottlieb was teaching at, and so I would go to her percussion ensemble concerts, and I was just like, uh-huh, oh my gosh, this percussion stuff, like, I mean, I knew it from like my dad's aspect too, but he was like the only one in that middle Georgia area that was doing anything like that. But to be around like multiple schools and all these programs, and the day of percussion being like an actual thing. Georgia's kicking it up a notch finally now. The PAS chapter, thanks to some of those awesome people that are making the chapter like actually do things and hold events. But at the time, like that wasn't happening so much. But Florida, it was popping. So I was just immersed in it. I loved it. Band competitions, all the stuff, every percussion ensemble concert I could go to, I was there. Like anyone's recital I could go to, if I could, I was there. So that really got me excited and about percussion. I still did choir, and I did like ACDA stuff. I did all state choir as well, and all of that sort of thing. And Florida is big with solo and ensemble, so that's really where all that four mallet stuff. Every year I was very gung-ho about preparing pieces for mallet specifically. I was to a problem only playing four mallets. Mm-hmm. You know, doing solo and ensemble for four mallets every single year. And then that was through all of that. That was like when I made the decision, I was like, I'm going to be doing this. Like, this is what I want to do. Somehow, some way, you know, I want to be a part of this world. So for me, like that initial reluctance and didn't want to go to Orlando was such a great thing looking back. And it was exactly where I needed to be. Definitely, because it just the way that things happened for me and the exposure to different things was, it was different than it would have been. It's not that I wouldn't have been exposed to percussion because that wasn't the case, but just the variety was insane. being, you know, all the different stuff, because I was so marching heavy. And then my final year of high school, I did WGI. Mm-hmm. So I got involved with that. I was a charter member of Infinity Percussion as one of the only high school students, I think. I think there was just a couple of us. And that was a huge, huge accomplishment for me. I loved doing that, and that was great. And I would have continued being a part of that had I stayed. But as soon as I graduated, I had already made that decision that I was going to go live with my dad for a couple years and work with him, study with him, get some of that time that I didn't have with him back, so to speak. And so it was too difficult for me to like drive back and forth to do WGI. Although there was a group in Atlanta at the time, but I just didn't really want to, I didn't want to be a part of that group. I wanted to be a part of Infinity, I guess. I auditioned for some drum corps, got in, but I was already teaching my first, like I started teaching band camp like a month after I graduated high school. And so I loved teaching so very much. And I just like couldn't stop doing that to do drum corps. And so I didn't. So I missed my opportunity to do drum corps, although that was something I really wanted to do. I ultimately decided not to. I was like fine, I guess, with my WGI experience. I don't think if I didn't do WGI, I probably would have done at least a year of drum corps, but I didn't end up doing it. So that was one of the only things that I thought I was going to do that I didn't do. But totally okay with that.
Wow. And wow, you talked about Orlando as much as you did. No mention of Disney World. That was impressive.
Oh, my mom works at Disney. Well, worked, because they laid off like over 20,000 people a few months ago. But there was a lot of Disney. Yeah. I know. There was a lot of Disney. We did a lot of parades and Candlelight, which my mom plays in the orchestra for. But they also do like the mass choir at Candlelight. And so our choir, my high school choir, would do that every year, too. At the time, it was a pretty sweet deal because they would give us 2 free tickets.
Nice.
Yeah. So there was a lot of Disney, but it's not one of those things that like, I don't know.
You're in town. Yeah. It's not
a life-changing thing. Now I like it more in a sense because I don't get to go, but and it's not that close. Like,
yeah, Orlando's a huge place.
It's like 40 minutes away. And when you're in high school and you have to pay for toll roads, it's a lot more difficult just to go drive down to Disney. The toll roads make it challenging, I would say. But there was a good amount of Disney, and I love Disney. I just wish they didn't fire all their musicians, but you know. Yeah.
Rest of Alyssa's story next week. Stay tuned. This week's rave is a book. Oh my gosh, I still read. And it is the 2018 memoir Born a Crime, written by the host of The Daily Show, Trevor Noah. And wow, truly one of the greatest memoirs I've ever read. Hopefully you already know who Trevor Noah is. He's a longtime stand-up comedian who became known to American audiences as both a stand-up and as a correspondent on The Daily Show towards the end of Jon Stewart's fabled run as host. He then won the hosting gig, following in Jon's footsteps. It was a tough road to hoe for a bit, but then Trevor established himself and his style during the previous presidency and has been a pretty fantastic host, doing so from his apartment in New York City over the past year during the pandemic. This memoir was written a few years ago, and it tells Trevor's story from the time of his birth and before until right around the time his stand-up career took off outside of South Africa. One of the brilliant parts of this memoir is that Trevor is likely well aware that his primary audience is from the United States. This matters because the memoir becomes part life story and part South African history lesson, the country of his birth. The title is derived from the fact that Trevor, as the child of a white father and black mother, is essentially illegally born under the laws of apartheid that he grew up in. This becomes part of his journey, as he is required to navigate his upbringing as someone who is always in the minority of every situation. He also writes to tell the story of much of the history of his home country. He explains the realities of life in South Africa under apartheid rule, the different tribes, languages, and cultures of the black Africans, and the evolution of the cities, towns, and townships there. He also talks about his family history and heavily features his mother, who deserves her own memoir at some point, as she is an amazing character and person. If you have seen Trevor Noah on The Daily Show, you know that he is both really funny and extremely smart and direct. He gets to the heart of the matter quickly and effectively and builds his narrative through some truly hilarious, harrowing, and soul-shattering tales. A marvel, a wonderful read, and I'm told one of the best audiobooks you'll ever listen to. Check out Born a Crime. You will enjoy. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. You can always find every episode of the show and the notes for every show at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episode. The show is also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, and many other podcast locations. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can find me there, on Instagram and Twitter at Pete Zambito, or by email at PetesPerkPod@gmail.com. I'll catch you next week for part 2 with Alyssa Castro-Evans. Until then.